I know that you've already said this, but the when you began this, you had to be thinking it was certainly going to be an epic length thing.
No, when I first started,
you did nothing.
No, I didn't actually. Oh. I didn't do that at all. I mean, in hindsight, it's amusing to think that we at one point thought it could be 90 minutes long, but we did, in fact, even sign a contract to that effect. Yeah, I was in hot water with my financier for like 2 years.
Okay.
Because I was meant to make a film that was 90 minutes long in time for the 50th anniversary. Mm. And we came out 2 years later. Everything doubled. The length, the budget, the schedule, everything.
Well, wasn't it estimated that it would probably be mainly a streaming thing with theatrical beginnings, and then that would be the most of the revenue?
I mean, No. I mean, really what happened was, it was meant to be a theatrical film.
Okay.
You know, along the lines of Amy or anything else. And then I couldn't cut it down. Like, I just kept, we edited it a different way than I've ever worked. We fine cut our way through from the beginning. So we had a working cut that was 2 hours long, and it only got to 1974. So that's when I said to my financier, I think the film wants to be roughly 4 hours long, and I would just like to keep going, you know? And if you think that these 2 hours are watchable, mm-hmm. I can give you another 2 hours that I think are gonna be even more watchable. And so we just moved forward, you know? And it was not till very late that we decided to give it a six-act structure, because you gotta give the audience a sense that they're kind of that they're making progress through this thing. And then, once it was 4 hours long, I felt that it could be seen in theaters with an intermission, and I think we're going to see that when it's in theaters in 50 cities on the 25th.
It's the richest thing I've gone through this year because of that whole immersive quality of watching it with a bunch of others, the break,
yeah.
And not realizing that part two would get me more than part one.
Yeah, oh man, that means a lot to me. Yeah.
Because it's very good, the first, it stopped around 70, 71?
74, yeah.
74?
Sorry, 73, yeah.
And I was thinking, well, that's good, but then I guess it's maybe the pathos of Jerry's slow wind down or the whole, and not really having been all that immersed myself in deadhead culture of the 80s, so.
Yeah.
So it was like, this is the payoff. And I finally saw what the whole thing was leading to.
I mean, I so appreciate you saying that. And I mean, you know, I made it, you know, the film was mixed for like 6 months. The band gave us their stems to the studio tracks so that we could actually remix the music and send it to the sides of the theater. So if you watch the movie in a theater with other people, you're literally in the music.
Mm.
And you know, Jerry's a little bit over here, and this is, you know, one somebody else is over in another part of the theater.
Mm.
And then that changes too. There are dynamics that change, you know.
Mm.
It wants to be seen in a movie theater. I hope a lot of people will see it in the movie theater. And yeah, but I'm laboring under no illusions. There's, of course, an advantage to having some place like Amazon have it, because it'll be seen globally, you know, on people's phones and things like that, you know, which doesn't excite me, you know, which makes up for the fact that I wish everybody could see it in the theater. But I think that rock and roll in general, you know, rock and roll in general can be a Trojan horse at this point, because rock and roll is so accepted.
The highest ranking members of the Senate.
Yeah. So because it's become so accepted, because it's been kind of loved to death,
mm-hmm.
everybody thinks it's harmless, but it isn't harmless.
Mm-hmm.
Rock and roll is not harmless.
Yeah.
And so I've always been so excited by the fact that that a place like Amazon is going to bring this into homes all over the world. It's going to show in Shanghai at a film festival coming up. I mean, there's no way the censors should let this show in Shanghai. I think this story is deeply subversive. Mm. You know, I mean, and so I love the idea that Jerry Garcia has become this harmless Santa Claus figure mm-hmm. in the public imagination, when in fact there is stuff in the way he conducted himself that's deeply threatening to our transactional world. Yeah. You know, and so people let him into their houses and it'll corrupt their youths. Mm. Their youth. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about it. But yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you had that experience. And you know, and the thing about Jerry's demise is he was caused by the very things that caused his ascendancy. You know?
I intend to see it again, yeah. but I want to see it with a crowd of real fans this time, just to feel their energy and the film together. I was seeing it, with the usual erudites,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Film critic crowd, you know.
People have been coming on psychedelics, which I don't think is a great idea, but I've been noticing it's been different than any film I've ever made, where at first I noticed that people were coming drunk, stoned. There was a screening in Salt Lake City, the final, the Salt Lake screening at Sundance, and it was unbelievable. I got up there at the beginning and I said, I have to tell you, I'd like to do the Q&A in the middle because I have to catch a flight and it's a little tight. So this woman comes up to me at the middle and she says, don't do the Q&A now. I work at the airport. I'll call over to some friends. We'll get you on we'll expedite your luggage. And she did all this. It was Grateful Dead-like in the sense that everybody's pulling together to make this experience.
I had just gotten here from Romania and I had never heard of them.
Yeah.
I would come away from this film and say, okay, I'm going to buy Working Man's Dead. I'm not going to buy Oxum.
Yeah.
Probably will buy Europe 72.
Yeah.
And, we'll see what else. Yeah. Maybe find some bootleg films.
Right.
But thanks to your film, I wouldn't have clue number one that there was an album called Live Dead. Now, why did you make the decision to not even mention it? I mean, I understand, though, everything but the title.
I don't even think I made that decision, Jeff. Because
that was a breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's all over the film. I mean...
Oh, the music is.
Yeah, the music is.
And how they found that thing, and that's what I loved about it. But the actual fact that you can catch the first thing...
Yeah, because I didn't feel... I mean, like, all I was really trying to do with the film is to create a hook so that, you know... The experience I'm hoping for in the audience for this film happens after they watch the film. You know, so like I didn't feel like I have to say, I don't mention Terrapin, I don't mention Box of Rain. There's plenty of stuff that I think is really important that doesn't make the film, simply because I was just trying to tell a great story.
You told the great story. I'm not supporting the film, I'm just saying anecdotally.
Yeah.
If I were saying doing a basic biopic about the Beatles, I would definitely mention the Abbey Road album, or I would mention something, and I just wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because you do mention very clearly, in fact, you detour into Working Man's Dead about how that was really. But you don't mention American Beauty.
Whenever there was a conflict between telling a perfect history.
Yeah.
Or versus telling, a good story. Story one. And there was nothing interesting about the words Live Dead, there's barely even anything interesting about the late 70s. I had to focus on things that, from a historical point of view, aren't even necessarily that interesting. I was trying to make a film like any of my other films. Take the audience on a narrative journey. And so I just had to go with the narrative. But,
were you any kind of fan of it before you got into this?
Yeah, I've been a fan since I was a teenager.
You didn't grow into it as you were making the film?
I became more of a fan while I was making it, but I really felt like the film is not for fans. The film is for people who think they don't like the Grateful Dead.
That's a good.
That's actually the. It's like also like meant to be a marriage counselor between people who love the band and their spouses who don't get them.
Right.
And so it's meant for future deadheads to give to their husbands and wives and say, here, this is me. But I mean, no, the film. I consider it. let me say this. As it turns out, there's not many people who are indifferent to Grateful Dead. There's
who are what?
Indifferent. There are people who love the band, and there are people who
like
are repelled by the people who love the band, and understandably so. Yeah. And this film is meant for them. This film is meant for people who think that they're who just never understood what the fuss was all about.
Speaking of which, my dream of seeing it with fans. Are there any plans for a big crowd and a big hall to see it together?
Yes. Oh yeah. So May 25th.
Okay.
It'll be shown one night only nationwide at 50 different theaters. Wherever you're going to be, it'll be a screening on May 25th.
Just stateside, right?
Just stateside in London. I think. London's in the works. Mm-hmm. And then May 26th through June 1st, it'll be showing in Los Angeles and New York as for a qualifying run.
Okay.
But May 25th, where are you going to be? Do you know?
I'm going to be in Cannes and Italy.
Okay. Well, I won't be there, unfortunately. Are you here? Well, that's tonight that there's a screening. Tonight there's going to be a screening with a lot of Deadheads if you want to pop in. But, I mean, you know, there's Red Rocks on May 25th, 12,000
seats. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that, Jeff. I would love for people to see this in theaters. You know, I mean...
It's funny, when I was a big fan of the John Scheinfeld doc about Harry Nilsson. You ever see that one?
I never saw that, Harry Nilsson. Yeah. Oh yeah, I gotta see that.
It waded into his alcohol problems.
Yeah.
Particularly the last 5 or 10 years of his life. And it just taught me that either the person with the issue has to be, at least the door has to be at least half open on their side.
Yeah.
To the idea of healing, cleaning up. But you cannot go to them and ask and get them to answer the door and open it up. They will, if they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it. And that was kind of what Jerry's situation was.
I mean, I think he used heroin as a buffer between himself and all the people who wanted something from him. So, you know, you would have had to have solved that problem as well as the chemical dependency.
Remind me the name of the girlfriend who he got back together
Bridget. Her name is Barbara Meyer, but her... She
that
changed
was a good
her name.
Find.
It says Barbara Bridget Meyer. Yeah.
That the chilling moment when she said, "Listen, I know you're using again, and I'm not judging. I'm not telling you to do anything, but just don't keep any secrets from me."
Yeah.
And he snapped at her.
Yeah, yeah.
That's heroin, man. That's drug
use. Yeah, yeah.
Because she seemed like a really nice lady.
He'd be still alive today if he hadn't made that decision. But I mean,
did you get? Was that a any kind of trouble to persuade her to?
Oh, hugely so. Yeah. I mean, she's not a person who seeks out publicity, also she was a little concerned because her role in Jerry's life was pretty conscribed. I mean,
pretty what?
Small.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
And she didn't want people to accuse her of grandstanding, and she didn't know me, and she wanted to make sure that I wasn't gonna disproportionately highlight her story. So she had to take a leap of faith to see that I was gonna, but also that I was gonna represent Jerry the way that she saw him, as a human being, and not as a cartoon, But I mean, what was I gonna say about her? The piece of tape that she has when you hear the two of them fall in love is priceless. It's a priceless piece of documentary archive.
Mm.
You know, the fact that he says, I had this dream while I was in my coma that you and I had continued our lives together. In a way, he's saying, I had a dream that I wasn't Jerry Garcia, that I had gone a different route and I still had the freedom to do whatever I wanted to do. And I feel like it's spine tingling, that stuff.
The interviews that I remember doing in 2009 about the Woodstock documentary, and I remember talking to somebody who was a Dead. I can't remember now. It would have been someone who was just with someone who knew them very well.
Yeah.
And he was it's kind of funny because, you know, sometimes they just weren't very good.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They weren't, like, nailing it every time. It
would that's the whole... That was...
Luck of the draw.
Part of the pact between the fans and the band was we allowed them to fail. and that was... So, and then what we got in return was... They gave us an authentic experience of music being made, not showbiz being performed. And that if you really want to, it was just in some ways closer to sports than music than entertainment. Because in sports, you know, your team gets up there and does the best they can, and it's real and it's spontaneous and it's unscripted, and there's an enjoyment to that, even when they lose. And so too with the Grateful Dead. You know, weren't able to pull off a good show, it was still highly enjoyable in the same way that a baseball game is, even if your team loses.
What's the deal with Bob Weir's, you talked to me about, when are you going to start aging, Jeff?
Yeah.
What about, Bob Weir didn't, for 35, 40 years, he looked like he was 22 years old.
Yeah. What's
and just like that, now he looks like Klondike Pete from the Yukon.
I don't know. Just
like that. Yeah. It's just like you flipped over a coin. Okay, enough of that.
Yeah. I don't know these guys that well. You know, I wasn't really interested in getting to know them as people because they're rock stars and I feel like they have enough friends. So I don't really know.
Yeah.
I commune with him daily when I'm listening to his music. But, you know, I had the desire to have the kind of relationship with him when I pick up the phone or whatever.
And here's another ill-informed question. I think I read in the press notes that there's an album to go with this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Currently available?
Here, let me show you. Just okay. I'll just show it. Do you have the album? Oh, you just show Jeff.
Right.
These are fresh off the presses to the point where they're not even real yet. These are just dummy discs because I'm going to do a talk show, but that's my first Grateful Dead album that I've produced. First and last, probably. But it's
this goes inside that, or this is
There's two versions, the Amazon version and the
hardcore version,
this is the Amazon version. You get an extra disc, but it's got his Watts Towers thing in there, which I'm pretty stoked about.
This is
I'll get you a copy of that. It's not yet ready. These discs won't play. They're not real.
Okay.
But
be out concurrent with the first.
It'll be out like that the week of the qualifying run.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you feel are you ready to start something new? Because you're quite
industrious. Thanks. No, I'm not. I'm actually pretty slow. I mean, No, I'm not ready to start anything new. I'm tired. This one took a lot out of me.
How have things changed since you began?
Well, I'll tell you this one thing. I mean, that screening I mentioned to you where the woman said so it's like my last night in Park City in Utah at Sundance, and I made a plan to speak to like a group of high school kids, which I like to do when I'm up there through like the Sundance Institute or whatever. So I was sitting around a table with them, getting ready to go into the screening, and the woman and these and I was giving them this very jaundiced idea about like how hard it is to make a living. I was trying to be like, you know, real useful in the sense. And this one woman probably correctly pointed out, you know, that I was maybe too jaundiced. And she goes, okay, you've been sitting here tell us about, you know, how hard it is to get these things financed and distributed and how tough it is. And just tell us, like, if you had all the money in the world and could just wave a magic wand and make any film, what would it be? Which I thought was a really good question. I started to answer it. I started to cry because I realized, like, fuck, I just made it. You know, like, I did it, you know, like, I fulfilled, like, a personal goal, you know, that that I've had, you know, since I was a kid, in a way, you know? I mean, so aside from my kids, this is the thing that I'm really most proud of. And I'll probably dine out on it for a little bit before I do something else, you know? Although I have to figure out, you know.
You know, those, whenever anybody asks me about it, say, what's your favorite film? There's, I don't think like that. Yeah. I don't think that any person who's into creating anything thinks like that.
Yeah.
It's just what happens is the process is you're searching, you're open to, you're listening, and then something, a little button, a little something taps you on the shoulder, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true and so important. And that's why I think it's so great that you said that, because that's really like the Grateful Dead in a nutshell, is this sort of like trying to create a perpetual now, you know, and I mean, that's what I think all thinking people are trying to do in a certain way, and yet you're always pulled into this sort of death-oriented thing, you know, which is sort of, it's like through this film, I've been thinking a lot about like what is a living thing and what is a dead thing, and there's a lot of things that are on some level living, but they're actually dead things. You know what I mean? Like. Just like hero worship, or you know, just sort of like that's sort of like monumentalizing the things is part of like, it's not part of the creative process.
You know? Get into unhealthy, obsessive habits when you're working really hard. You sort of forget about living and eating responsibly.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard of people, you know, eating bad food when they're in the editing room, that kind of thing.
I'm always, my life is a constant tension between, you know, like trying to think of the future and trying to like live in the present. But most people are. I don't know.